The Guardian.
I'm Alok Jha, and this is Science Weekly for October the 6th. On this week's podcast, one of the only scientists who can invoke Harry Potter to explain condensed matter physics, Imperial College London's Sir John Pendry. Also in the show, we talk to Graham Watkins of the Charles Darwin Foundation about the threat to Darwin's paradise, the Galapagos Islands. Plus, we find out why the expensive plonk you bought at an upmarket chateau in Bordeaux tastes so bad when you bring it back to your one-bed flat in London, and Science Weekly does an experiment of its own. And we find out why neighbours of nuclear power stations actually quite like them. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. In the pod with me today are The Guardian's full science contingent, James Randerson. Hello, James.
Hello.
Ian Sample.
Hello.
Good to have you back. Also here is physics fan and arts desk commander, Nell Bowes. Hello, Nell.
Hello, Alok.
Good to have you all. Now, talking of physics, and because we haven't had quite enough quantum mechanics and general relativity these past few months, we've got a guest this week that will rebalance things. Professor Sir John Pendry is head of the physics department at Imperial College London, and probably best known as the inventor of the invisibility cloak. With stints at Cambridge University and Daresby Lab in Cheshire, he spent much of his illustrious career working on solid-state theory, and, in particular, creating materials that have unexpected properties around light. He was knighted for services to science in 2004, and last week, if you were in South Kensington, you might have seen Pendry Fest, a celebration of all things John Pendry. John, welcome to the pod.
Thank you.
Not many physicists, I'm assuming, have festivals named after them, but how did that come about?
Oh, it's a German tradition that when you're 60, you have a festival to celebrate the fact that you're going to leave soon.
Is that to encourage you out the door?
Well, not in this case, because they're actually keeping me on for another 5 years.
Good.
And I was 65, not 60.
Well, happy birthday. We've got to get to this, the invisibility cloak. I'm sure that you're almost sick of talking about this, but tell us about this. This is probably why people might have heard of you. This is the invisibility cloak, where it's a shield which allows light to sort of go around it. You probably explain it better than I do. Tell us about it.
Well, it began with something highly theoretical that had to do with Einstein's relativity and whatnot, which we felt enabled us to control light in a very particular and special way. And the next thought was, how could we tell this to people in a way that everybody might understand the power of the method? And we came up with the idea that if we could hide something and make it invisible, that might impress people.
And so, for those people without physics degrees, how does it work?
How does it work? Well, if you want to hide something, you've got to do two things. One is, it mustn't reflect any light, and that's conventional stealth. So if you make an aircraft stealthy, it doesn't reflect radar waves, so you don't see it that way. But there's another way you can see things, and that's through the absence of light, through a shadow. So if you play squash, you play it with a black ball in a white court, and what you're actually not seeing, I suppose, is the shadow. Now, getting rid of the shadow is a much harder task than getting rid of the reflections. And the way we do it is to coat the object you're trying to hide with a cloak. And the cloak is designed so that when light hits it, it does a chicane around the object. But then you mustn't throw the light away, because then you'd see the shadow. And the light must escape the other side, going in exactly the same direction it was before. So you appear to see through the cloak, i.e. you don't see the cloak or its contents.
And so, for military purposes, this sounds fascinatingly useful. How far has it gone now? Someone has built this material, and it does work to an extent, and you can sort of see there's something there, but you can also see behind it. Where's it gone to now?
Well, the first cloak was built just over a year, 18 months ago, and it was rather imperfect, because we wanted to demonstrate the principle. So there are two things that have to be done. One is to make it more precise, and the other is to make it effective over a broader spectrum of radar frequencies. At the moment, the cloak worked just for one particular band of radar, and people would like it to work over a wide band. Of course, people would also like it to work for visible light, but that's pretty hard.
Do you reckon it'll be possible? Do you reckon it will actually be possible to have clothes that you can see through?
Not in my lifetime.
All right, well, we'll believe
I don't
you.
Think so.
That work, actually, is part of a larger sort of a contingent of stuff, obviously, that you're doing on something called metamaterials. Now, what are metamaterials?
If you look at how to control light, we use things like glass or plastic to make lenses and redirect it. And in nature, there's a pretty restricted range of materials that you can use. Nature doesn't offer all the things which should be possible according to the big guy in electromagnetism who's James Clerk Maxwell. Maxwell says a whole range of properties that are possible. We don't find them all in nature. And so metamaterials are a way of doing something new, which enables new sorts of materials to be formed. And the idea is this, that glass owes its properties to its chemical composition. So you want a really sparkly wine glass, you add some lead to the glass and it makes it more refractive and sparkles. But there's another way to change the properties, and that's to alter the microstructure. So we add structure to the chemistry. And those two are a very powerful combination, and you can achieve properties that have never been achieved in nature before.
And one of the other things that you're working on is the perfect lens. And this is something that will allow, well, if it's built, well, a light to be focused into an area smaller than the actual wavelength of light itself. First of all, how does that work? And then there are some interesting uses for that.
It works through the application of these metamaterials. An ordinary lens works by redirecting rays of light and bringing them to a focus. But rays of light are only one component of the signal which an object gives out. And because the information is incomplete, that's why you don't have resolution better than the wavelength. But there's another way of focusing light using metamaterials, because one of the weird properties we can obtain is a material with a negative refractive index. And that means that the material behaves, as far as light is concerned, as though it's a negative piece of space. So that's sort of weird.
A negative piece of space?
What does that mean?
I'm not even sure what that means.
Well, if I wanted to see you up close, then I want to annihilate the space between us, right? So if I can put a block of negative space in between me and you, you appear much closer. And this is a completely different principle from making a lens, getting rid of space. And it turns out that you can get rid of space in a very complete way, so that you see not just the rays of light, but all the other bits of electricity and magnetism as well. And if you do it right, if your negative space is sufficiently well made, then you can see every fine detail of an object.
I think there's a lot of negative space in my head, actually. But that idea of the perfect lens, though, just before we open this up to the pod, is interesting, because you suggested that it could be used for things like MRI and so on, to actually focus the rays of light, well, the electromagnetic waves that they produce, into a much more tight area. Can you go into that a little bit?
Yes, there are a lot of instances where the wavelength is a real restriction on what you can see and the techniques you can use with it. Magnetic resonance imaging uses radiation which is of a wavelength of 15 meters, so you couldn't even see the body you were trying to operate on if you used it to image. So if you're going to focus the radiation they use in MRI, then you're going to have to use a different principle. And one of the possibilities we're looking at is using negative refraction to direct the radiation used in MRI to the parts of the body where it's needed.
Okay, well, I'm going to open this up to the pod. Our own material scientist, Ian Sample, is ready with some hard questions.
A long time ago, actually. No, John, I was just going to ask you if you could take us through some of the practical hurdles of creating one of these cloaks for optical wavelengths and for broadband wavelengths as well. Is it just that with light, the wavelengths are so much smaller that it becomes just a fiddlier job?
Exactly.
Right.
The structure you introduce to create the properties of the metamaterial has to be much smaller than the wavelength of light you're using. So for radar, that means the structures must be a few millimeters. Mm. But for visible light, the wavelength is already a millionth of a meter or less. And so you're talking about nanometers. And nanoscience has many wonderful things, but it's still developing. And we can't just make anything we want in nanoscience. We need very, very advanced technology to make the things we need.
And what about, so just ask a bit about the doing broadband as well. I mean, is that actually possible? Will you only really ever be able to make these cloaks sort of very good for one particular wavelength?
The theory says that they can be perfect only at one wavelength. And the rate at which the performance degrades as you move away from that particular colour or wavelength depends on how thick you make the cloak. So if you want a really thin cloak, it will only work at one wavelength. But if you're prepared to have a thicker cloak, which wouldn't really be a cloak, it would be more a shed than a cloak, I suppose.
Invisibility shed. I like that.
Indeed. then you can have a broader band performance. As usual with practicalities, you have to make a trade-off.
I'm glad you said the theory says, because you came up with a theory. I'm sure that we wouldn't have come up with that ourselves. James?
And is there a practical problem about the size of the object that you're trying to hide, or does that not make any difference? Is it harder with larger objects?
Well, it is, because these materials are going to cost quite a bit of money when you first manufacture them. Cheaper ways will be found, I guess, with time. But if you wanted to hide a really large optical object, then think of how many billions of nanometers you'd have to make inside that, and that would be very expensive. I think in a year or two's time, you'd be able to make a fairly big cloak for radar waves, but that's different from optical waves, I think.
No?
I was just wondering, out of all these crazy materials and uses and functions, what are you most excited about?
What am I most excited about? Well, my latest idea, of course. But that's always the most exciting one. I want to combine this idea of a perfect lens, which makes light go backwards in space because space is negative in some weird sense, with another weird idea which has been around for a long time, and that is to make light go backwards in time reversal. That's been possible for quite a long time, and I think we can actually use that technology to make a perfect lens.
Are we just going to let that time travel thing go? I don't know. I don't know if it's
worth. Body's just completely gobsmacked.
I'm stunned.
Do you want to just take us through the time travel bit there?
No, it's not time travel. if you have light emitted from some object, say a light bulb or a laser or whatever, and it goes on some complicated path, rattling around the room, whatever, and you have it impinge on a time reversal mirror, which is technical phrase is four-wave mixing, but we won't go into that. The light bounces on this off this special mirror, and instead of going off at an angle the way it does off a regular mirror, it goes right back along the path that it came along in a very perfect way. So, for example, one of the uses is that if you want to direct a laser to a satellite, you first send up a weak laser beam that reflects off the satellite, and you cannot focus a laser on a satellite because of the atmospheric turbulence, which smashes the beam all over the place, like stars twinkling, you see. The laser beam twinkles by the time it gets up to a satellite, so it's not very intense. So you have a weak reflection from the satellite, which you then detect, and you bounce it off a time reversal mirror plus enormous amplification, and that sends it right back to where it came from and undoes all the twinkles and does whatever you want to the satellite.
Some of the stuff is either very, very weird, very, very interesting.
But that's been around for a while.
Well, you say that, but to us it's new.
Do you have people in like dark cars following you with like the blacked out windows and sort of earpieces? I mean, all this sounds deeply sort of interesting, sort of for causing a lot of havoc in the world.
I tell you, this is all stuff out of Lost and Alias and all those sorts of programs. They must have a hotline
a direct line to
John Pendry's Tom Pendry's lab. John, just let me wind up this bit by asking you about something which I read, which is your proudest achievement, despite the fact we talked about some phenomenal new physics and these perfect lenses and invisibility cloaks. Your proudest achievement is your knighthood. Now, can you just explain that to us a little bit?
Well, the way I usually explain it is of all the various bits and pieces I've accumulated over the years, it's only the only one my aunt is heard of.
Well, that's brilliant. Well, we'll
pause. Head of Science Weekly.
She will after this. We'll pause the physics there for now, but John will be with us for the rest of the programme, so we'll hear plenty more from him in the coming half hour. I'm Alok Jha, you're listening to Science Weekly from The Guardian. Still to come, how the Galapagos Islands are being ruined by tourists, plus the Ig Nobels, the most desired awards in science, it says here. Oh, and don't forget the live science experiment. Before any of that, here's a roundup of the news from the past week. This is Nell and James with the News Jam.
News Jam.
The world must take drastic action within 2 years to reduce levels of greenhouse gases if it is to avoid the worst effects of climate change, according to scientists at the UK Met Office's Hadley Centre. Cutting global emissions by 3% a year from 2010 offers the only possible hope of avoiding a global temperature rise of more than 2 degrees C. This is widely recognised as the threshold beyond which the worst impacts of sea level rise and drought become a significant risk.
More information about the level of pain and suffering animals endure during lab experiments should be made public. So say a group of scientists who are advising ministers on how to change the regulations governing animal research. They say the change will make animal research in the UK more transparent, and this will lead to improvements in the experimental procedures to minimise suffering.
People who live close to nuclear power stations are more supportive of building new plants than the UK population in general. That's according to independent researchers who have conducted the most detailed survey of attitudes to the nuclear industry since the mid-1980s. 62% of respondents said the benefits of nuclear energy either far outweigh or slightly outweigh the risks. The equivalent figure in a national survey conducted in 2005 was 32%.
And finally, there really is comfort in religion, apparently. In experiments at Oxford University, Roman Catholic volunteers were given mild electric shocks. They felt less pain with these shocks than atheists and agnostics when they were shown a painting of the Virgin Mary. MRI scans showed that in devout believers, an area of the brain that suppresses reactions to threatening situations lights up when they are shown the picture.
Thank you both. Let's go into a few of those. The animal pain story, James, it's an emotive issue. The scientists in this case are saying they want more transparency, but what's really going on?
Well, it's in one sense, it's quite a small change, but it will give certainly more information, but it may not. Well, it certainly won't go as far as some who oppose these kind of experiments would like. Essentially, what happens at the moment is when you're applying for a licence for an experiment, and incidentally, the institution, the person doing the experiment and the project itself have to be licensed by the Home Office. When you're doing that, there's a kind of cost-benefit analysis. You predict how much pain and suffering is likely to be perpetrated in those experiments, and that is sort of traded off against the benefits and also the extent to which other methods have been tried in the past, etc. Then when you do your experiment, you report how many animals went through. So you might come up with the idea that 10 rats had substantial suffering. There are three bands of suffering that they have: substantial, moderate, and mild. But the reality might be that fewer than that actually had that level of suffering, because nobody actually reports what happened in the experiment itself. So what they're proposing doing now is saying, scientists, you have to say in that experiment how many of the animals suffered at the three different levels. Because at the moment what tends to happen is that scientists obviously don't want to go beyond the bounds of their licence, and so they think there may be a kind of tendency to overestimate the degree of pain that is involved in an experiment, so that when the experiment happens, you don't exceed that. So it's more information, but what we certainly won't have is a kind of a rundown of all the experiments and all the institutions with 100 rats suffered substantially here or whatever. It'll come out as national figures.
All right, well, from animal pain to nuclear power, don't say we don't deal with serious subjects on this show. Nuclear power. So people who live near nuclear power stations are quite keen on them. Why is that?
I suspect it's because people who, you know, the communities around nuclear power stations are, you know, full of people who work there or know people who work there or, you know, the local
economy.
They know
the beast.
They know the beast, yeah. It's the devil you know rather than the devil you don't know. And it's quite an interesting piece of work. University of East Anglia and others collaborated over 5 years to do some, well, partly kind of detailed kind of interviews with people who live close to power stations and then a larger survey of over 1,300 people who live close to two power stations and asked lots of questions. And the overall picture is that they are generally much more favourable to nuclear power than people tend to be generally and less keen on things like renewable energy, which is quite interesting, I thought. I mean, you might imagine from the start that, you know, if you live next to them, you'd be constantly trying to campaign against them, but that's not the case.
If you think nuclear power stations are, when they're built, they're put in very out-of-the-way places. If you think of Sellafield, when that was built, it actually created the community that lives there. So an enormous number of the people around there are employed at Sellafield or surrounding businesses. And I think it would be interesting to know the views of the people where government plans to build nuclear power stations before they're actually there. But then maybe that doesn't matter too much anyway, because as soon as you build it, you will then again import your new community who will be supportive of it because they work in the industry anyway. So it just seems, I just wonder how meaningful the study is. I mean, people who work in nuclear power stations like nuclear power stations, doesn't surprise me.
All right, well, we were going to talk about the religion stuff, but I think we'll leave it hanging on there for now. Have your comments on that on the blog. Remember, if you want to have your say on any of this stuff, go to guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. Now, they convey a prestige and honour that's unique in the academic world. Many past winners have gone on to become household names and to change the course of science. No, we're not talking about this week's Nobel Prizes, but their irreverent cousins, the Ig Nobels, which were awarded last Thursday at Harvard University. Ian, you've been knee-deep in Ig Nobel papers. Take us through a couple of the gems from this year.
Well, the good news is there were two British winners. One of them actually, not the science prize, but the Ig Nobel for Literature, which I particularly liked. It was by a guy called David Sims at the Cass Business School in London. He wrote a paper which the first two words were, "You bastard." And it was a narrative exploration of bastards in the workplace. And what he did, I said, "Well, how did you get to working on this?" He said, "Well, look, he works on understanding how people operate in the workplace." And so he wanted to find out what it is, what the different types of bastard you might find in the office might be, and how they come to be like that. And essentially he said this lovely quote about how we're all novelists writing the next chapter of our life story. And he said that with these people that he branded bastards, you have to understand the narrative, the character that they're trying to write for themselves. And if you can understand sort of the story that they're trying to write for themselves, you may have a better understanding of why they are as they are and why they cause
perhaps,
so much conflict.
Perhaps some of these narratives are not actually worth reading. You know, I don't
know. No. I mean, they were, believe me. I mean, I'll direct you to the paper. They're really funny. It has some good, really nice case studies in there. The chemistry Ig Nobel was interesting as well. It was jointly awarded to two researchers, one for showing that the fizzy drink Coca-Cola is a spermicide. The others showed that it wasn't a spermicide.
That's proper science. You know, you publish whatever you publish and you draw conclusions
after
that.
You look at the body of the research
absolutely.
Rather than individual papers.
No, absolutely. Let me open this up slightly. John, you've been looking at that list of winners. Do any of them strike out as interesting to you?
Yes, I wonder whether you have to drink the Coke or whatever.
I don't know. John, what's some of your favourite ones?
I guess I like that cognitive neuroscience one where Emma Boyd, organisms can solve puzzles. Physicists solve puzzles. I don't like to think of myself as an amoeba.
As Mark Abrahams, the organiser of the Ig Nobels, always says, that this is all genuine research, published and everything. You know, we can laugh about it for a little bit, but I particularly like the Peace Prize, which went to the Swiss Federal Ethics Committee on Non-Human Biotechnology for acknowledging the dignity of plant life, which is, you know, important, I think. It's necessary, especially with vegetarians. vegetarians out there, you know. Right, we said that there were two winners from Britain, and one of them Ian's already talked about. The second winner was Charles Spence, Oxford University, and he researches how sounds affect our sense of taste. I spoke to him.
OK, so this was our research we did with Pringles crisps to try and show how important what you hear is to what you taste and how much you enjoy the food that you consume, food and drink, I should say. We'd have subjects in a soundproof booth. They'd be sitting there in the darkness. We'd open the door, hand them a Pringle. They'd bite into it. And we had a microphone kind of just below their mouth that would pick up the sounds of the crunch, play it out through a computer and some graphic equalizers, and then feed it back straight away so that in real time you would hear yourself biting into the crisp. And what we did was on each trial, for each Pringle, we changed the sound, sometimes making it quieter, sometimes louder, sometimes boosting just certain frequencies that are important when you break into a crisp. And what we were able to show is that people's judgments, the freshness, the staleness, the pleasantness of the crisps were kind of influenced by what they were hearing, and that we could actually make crisps about 15% crisper and fresher by getting the right sound compared to the normal sound you hear.
The work you did to win the coveted Ig Nobel is a part of a much wider sort of series of research you're doing on the environmental effects of sound. Can you give us some other examples of the stuff you're doing?
Okay. So we've gone on from this kind of original experiment to say, is it just crisps where sound is important? And the answer seems to be no, because if you take, say, a carbonated drink, fizzy water or a Coke or something, then there too you can change how fizzy the drink seems to be by changing the sound of the bubbles popping that people hear. And that seems to have a kind of a nice implications in terms of reducing the amount of acid in drinks that kind of rots teeth while keeping the perception the same.
You've also worked with Heston Blumenthal, the chef, mm-hmm. on making his restaurant experience a bit more sort of visceral for people. Can you take us through that?
Okay. So this is, again, follow on the effect of sound on food perception, but now we've sort of moved away from the sound of the food itself or the packaging to the sound of the environment in which you eat the food. And this has been based on our experiments where we've shown that if you eat bacon and egg ice cream, one of the dishes in the Fat Duck restaurant, you can actually flip people's perception of what flavour the ice cream has. Is it more bacony or more eggy, by changing the soundtrack that you play in the room where they eat the ice cream? So we've tried this with sizzling bacon sounds that make the food taste more bacony, or with farmyard chicken sounds that make the ice cream taste more eggy. And we've tried to incorporate this into the restaurant in what is now kind of the signature dish at the Fat Duck restaurant, the Sound of the Sea seafood dish, where Heston gives his diners a plate of food. It looks like the seashore. It has sand and foam and seaweed and some seafood there. But when you're presented with the dish, on the table in front of you is also placed a big seashell, out of which comes two little tiny iPod earphones. And so diners will put those earphones on and then start to eat. And when they put those earphones on, they actually hear the sound of the sea, seagulls, waves crashing on the beach. And we know from our experiments that will make the seafood taste more enjoyable.
Does this actually work in terms of, you know, do people really believe that the food is tasting better? Or is it some sort of expectation to set up that then they're fulfilling?
It may be both things that are going on. As kind of psychologists, we're always worried about, is it our subjects is trying to please us to... or is it a real perceptual effect? But we have a number of techniques to prove it's a real perceptual phenomenon. And to give just one example, when you do the sound of the sea, we've been able to show that that changes your perception of the pleasantness of the seafood, but it doesn't alter your perception of how salty it is. So it's suggesting it's quite a specific effect.
There are health benefits to some of this research.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Kind of at a couple of levels. Firstly, in terms of the carbonation and reducing that in drinks, as I mentioned before. But secondly, in terms of, say, the ageing population, where as more and more people get to live 60, 70 and beyond, that's the stage when you really start to see the decline in our sense of taste and our sense of smell. And so using sound to kind of bring back some more excitement and enhance the flavour of foods really seems to offer a kind of great potential to try and get older people to eat more healthily and to enjoy food experiences.
And for those people who are listening to this and think, "Well, God, you know, I can't see the much point to this stuff for me," mm-hmm. You've got an interesting anecdote about, you know, buying food abroad, which is quite nice.
So when you kind of speak to people everyone seems to have had the experience that when they go on holiday, say for English people to the Mediterranean, we have the sun, we have the sound of the sea and they're warm, and we go out for a meal or we go to the shops, and the food always seems to taste wonderful. And one often finds wine that tastes so good, even though it's very cheap. And I myself and everyone I've spoken to kind of brings back half a case of such wine to try and impress one's friends at home that you can buy something so cheap that tasted so good. And yet time and time and time again, when you get home and open the bottle in front of your friends, one's kind of embarrassed to find that it tastes awful. It tastes exactly like you'd expect a €1 bottle of wine to taste. And we think that what's going on there is that when you bring the wine home, you don't have the sounds of the sea anymore. You don't have the warmth of the sun on your back. And so you're missing all those environmental cues that we use when we actually evaluate food. So I guess a practical thing for people at home would be that when you do bring the food back from abroad, the more of the sensory triggers you can recreate from the Mediterranean, be it in terms of the warmth or the smells or the sounds, any of those cues should help to improve flavour and quality of the food.
Charles Spence there from Oxford University. Now, on Science Weekly, we're not just content to report the science, we're going to try and let you experience some of it for yourselves. If you want to experience the crisp experiment we're about to do for yourselves, pause your MP3 player and find a bag of crisps. If you've got that now, after three, bite into a crisp. Is everyone here ready, by the way? get that open. Get those crisps open. Okay, after three, are you ready? Okay.
Wait, are we going?
Are we all going at once?
Are we eating on the
Wait.
Look at the script. One, two, three, crunch.
One, two, three, crunch. Not yes. One, two, crunch.
Yes. No, 1, 2, 3, crunch.
Traditionally.
Okay. All right, are you ready, everyone? Now, after three. 1, 2, 3. Okay, well, what you're hearing is the slightly disgusting sound of James munching on some crisps. Stop it, James. Now we're going to mess around with the sound. Are you ready again? So once more, pod fans. John, I'm going to ask you after this sound effect whether you think this is a fresher crisp or not a fresher crisp. That was the control we just did there. So 1, 2, 3. John, did you think that was more or less fresh, that sound, despite the fact that it sounded quite horrible?
It sounded just the same, but then again, my high-frequency response is... Sorry.
See, it wouldn't work, the fact that wouldn't work for you. That was actually with the same sound effect, but with the top end of frequencies boosted by the magic of podcasting. We're going to try it one more time.
See, this is now going beyond what Charles Spence did. So we're going into unknown territory.
We're going into
here.
Unknown territory.
This is new research.
Yeah, get informed nature.
I love the fact that Nell's got her crisps lined up, unlike the rest of you. 1, 2, 3. That was the crisp with the bottom end boosted, it says here. Mm. That sounds a bit rude.
I would just eating crisps with the same noise. I mean, when we were recording this earlier, it's absolutely horrible listening to yourself eating.
It's horrible listening really to crisp. You eating as well, to be honest with you. You know what? I feel really sorry for Kate having to edit this together because I don't know what she's going to do with any of this, to be honest. And James, when you've actually written up the paper... and submitted it to Nature. Let's hear about it. We're going to stop that nonsense there. All of you, stop eating crisps immediately.
I hate crisps.
You're addicted.
Okay, we'll stop all of that nonsense there. Post your results from our crunching experiment on the blog. The renowned role that the Galapagos Islands played in the work of Charles Darwin, not to mention their rugged beauty, have now made them a major tourist attraction. The Ecuadorian government and NGOs have made a huge effort to protect the island's fragile ecology, but large numbers of visitors are threatening to undo that good work. Ian Sample spoke to Graham Watkins, executive director of the Charles Darwin Foundation, which has worked on the islands for 48 years, about the problems they face. But first, let's hear a little of Charles Darwin's thoughts when he first set foot on the Galapagos Islands in the 1830s.
In the morning, we landed on Chatham Island, which, like the others, rises with a tame and rounded outline, broken here and there by scattered hillocks, the remains of former craters. Nothing could be less inviting than the first appearance, a broken field of black basaltic lava thrown into the most rugged way.
My name is Graham Watkins. I'm the executive director of the Charles Darwin Foundation.
And what to you are the value of Galapagos in any respect? What do you see as the value of these particular islands?
I think that there are multiple values to the islands, and I think that one of the things about Galapagos that makes it very, very special is it's one of these wilderness areas that changes the way people view the world, their lives in some way been changed, their perspective on life has some way been changed, because the wildlife in Galapagos is extraordinarily tame. So one of the features is that you can actually get approached by sea lions, birds will come down and in some cases actually sit on your shoulders and things like that. And those kinds of experiences are actually few and far between in the world. And that's probably one of the reasons why it changes life. In fact, Darwin noticed this as well and actually spent quite a bit of time talking about the tameness of the birds in Galapagos. He thought it was quite extraordinary.
A gun here is almost superfluous, for with the muzzle, I pushed a hawk off the branch of a tree. One day, whilst lying down, a mocking thrush alighted on the edge of a pitcher made of the shell of a tortoise, which I held in my hand, and began very quietly to sip the water.
Basically, you've got animals that are very similar to mainland animals, but different. Mm-hmm. But then from island to island, they're also different. Those were the characteristics that Darwin saw. And Darwin particularly picked up on that with respect to the Galapagos mockingbirds, the giant tortoises. And that's one of the places, or one of the features, that really triggered Darwin to start thinking about the fact that that's not terribly consistent with special creation. I think that for that reason alone, Galapagos is an extraordinary place, an extraordinarily important place culturally because of the impact of the publication of The Origin of Species on the way the Western world thinks about the world in which we are.
The dry and parched surface, being heated by the noonday sun, gave to the air a close and sultry feeling, like that from a stove. We fancied even that the bushes smelt unpleasantly. Although I diligently tried to collect as many plants as possible, I succeeded in getting very few, and such wretched-looking little weeds would have better become an Arctic rather than equatorial flora.
The government of Ecuador is taking very seriously the fact that Galapagos is at risk. Ultimately, what you have to do is create a sustainable society in Galapagos, which will then result in the conservation of the islands. And the keys to sustainability are ensuring that you have good governance. The second thing is you have to look at tourism itself and make sure that the tourism is sustainable. So it's not so much growth in numbers oriented, but it's growth in quality oriented. And the third area is the whole area of education and capacity building, which is also critical. So building into a community, many of whom are relatively recent immigrants within the last 20 or 30 years, a sense of how do you live in an island system. And there are many, many things. You have to understand invasive species, you have to understand energy use, you have to understand recycling, and all of those kinds of things. And there have been some advances in this already. And at the same time as you're doing those three things, you also need to be putting out the fires that you know are going to arrive anyway. And one of the interesting steps the government has taken in that sense is that they just a year ago approved what we're calling the Total Control Plan for Invasive Species in Galapagos. And linked to that, they're now completing the raising of about $15 million that would act as a trust fund, which would then give us the financing to be able to respond to emergencies in Galapagos. So this year, for example, the Mediterranean fruit fly was found in Galapagos, which is a horrific invasive species. So we immediately needed funds to be able to work on trying to work out how to eradicate it, how to control it. There are a lot of ways that you can control it. They've been looked at, including infertile males and things like that. But that will take funding, and it takes readily available funding that can be applied to the problem directly. And so we're now looking at how we do that. But the quicker you respond, the more likely you are to be successful. The longer you let it wait with a species that's already begun to explode, the more difficult it gets.
That was Graham Watkins, Executive Director of the Charles Darwin Foundation. Ian, it's obviously quite a big issue, this. How big is the tourism industry around the Galapagos?
Well, it's really the rate at which it's been increasing, growing, that's pretty alarming. I mean, it's growing 14% a year, but to put that into actual sort of something more meaningful, the number of visitors has risen from like 40,000 in 1990 to 140,000 a couple of years ago. And the actual population that lives there, the actual full-time residents, if you like, that's also doubled from 1990 to 120,000. So you're actually getting more visitors going there than people who live there, but the actual population that's sort of on the islands, and they're based on about four of these 13 or so major islands there. It's all going up, and that's a consequence, actually, of the success of the conservation effort. I mean, that has been so good that it has made it such a tourist attraction. And as we heard from Darwin's words, and also others who first came across these islands, they're actually pretty bleak. I mean, there was one guy who came along after Darwin who really spun it up and put a great, you know, turned it into this paradise, iconic paradise that we all now think of. It's only some of the islands are beautiful and lush. A lot of them are these horrendous lava fields, barren, hostile, zero fresh water except for a couple of times a year. But obviously the problem they face is that with this incredible economic boom they have going on, with people living there, their relatives coming over and all the tourists, far more traffic going in and out. So it's very porous borders. You're bringing in a lot of invasive species on the ships and on the planes.
Let's look at our blog now. James wrote a piece there on a spat between two academics. Philosopher A.C. Grayling was less than congratulatory when reviewing sociologist Steve Fuller's book, Dissent Over Dissent. In the New Humanist magazine, Grayling said it was nearly 300 pages of wasted forest. Before we jump into the comments, James, give us a really quick background on this.
Steve Fuller is obviously a sociologist who famously spoke at the Dover Intelligent Design Trial in 2005, I think, and he was on the side of the defence, defending the principle of being able to teach intelligent design alongside evolution in science classes. And he's written this book, and A.C. Grayling not that keen on it, really. So, but we've had a few responses. Zosimus says, do these blockheads never ask themselves, if life is a result of intelligent design, why has it been designed to proceed by creatures tearing other creatures down horribly, eating them alive and turning them into crap? Read the Guardian report about Komodo dragons taking 3 days to eat a caribou alive. If they said it was the result of stupid design, they might have more of an argument.
I think it was not a caribou, I think it might have been a buffalo. Will G says,
Steve Fuller really is a strange one. I heard him talk a year back, and although he lost me a bit, he came across as intelligent and intellectually curious. He's certainly not your average Bible-bashing creationist. As far as I understand it, although I haven't and won't read his book, his argument is to challenge the objectivity and independence of science such that it becomes just another text to be interpreted as social and cultural construction and thus no better than ID. This kind of postmodernism is, of course, just as ridiculous as creationism, although it certainly is a different question. I think Fuller just likes the attention and only allies himself to the forces of darkness to get into the papers.
I think Will G's point about postmodernism is absolutely, absolutely correct. And if anyone wants to hear more about that sort of stuff, you can listen to an interview with Alan Sokal that we did a few months back, who dissects postmodernism and all its associated nonsense very well, I think. All right, well, thanks for those comments. Do keep writing in. We're going to come back to our studio guest now, John Pendry of Imperial College London. John, why do you think that physics gets a bit of a bad press?
I think there are two reasons, maybe more. One is that physics was enormously successful in the period after the war, I suppose, partly because of its contribution to the war and partly because of the things which it contributed afterwards, such as the transistor and the laser. But now, science in general, the hotspot is moving on very much to the biosciences. So there's, in my view, a mistaken perception that physics is a science of the past. I don't think it is, because my view of physics is that it takes on a new role. Many of these achievements in the new sciences are actually underpinned by physics. And I see physics as acting towards, say, the biosciences as the same way that the machine tool industry does to the rest of industry. That's a more humble role, but it's a very, very, very important role. And you can see it in all sorts of ways, from, for example, DNA and all the contributions that makes. Underpinning that are the structural analyses which go on at the synchrotron radiation facilities, which help with drug design, for example. And that's physics.
I think perhaps you should go into teaching physics at schools. So, John Pendry, thank you so much.
Have we managed to get through an entire show with an eminent physicist in the chair and haven't mentioned the LHC once?
Oh, you... That was on purpose. It was on purpose. Oh, stop it. No more LHC chat for at least another 2 weeks. Well, that's it for this week's show. My thanks to James Randerson, Ian Sample and Nell Bowes, and also many thanks to guest Professor John Pendry of Imperial College London. Remember to leave your thoughts on our show at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly, or you can write on our Facebook wall. Science Weekly was produced by Kate Taylor. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.